So we now move into a time of open discussion between Gary and Ken, and which of you would like to begin?
Well, if I may make a response. Thank you, Gary, for that contribution. I mean, it does open a door to many things. You mention about, you know, quoting scholars, which I know you are fond of, a ratio of 30 to 1 in terms of whether they agree more with you than with the position I'm stating. That's possibly true. I wouldn't doubt that those who doubt the official story are quite a minority. I mean, does that really surprise anybody? I mean, isn't it easier to believe than to think? You know, he mentions Bart Ehrman as a skeptic. What he doesn't mention is he actually used to be a born-again Christian evangelical. Why has he changed? Why has he changed? Because he studied the manuscripts in great detail over a long period of time. He lost his faith because he studied the data. Now, we're talking here of evidence for a fantastic event. You all are familiar with that phrase, extraordinary events require extraordinary evidence. Well, I'm not going to push the point that far, but I would say this, that we need pretty good evidence, not flaky evidence, not marginal evidence, not evidence that we can interpret with a favourable Christian gloss. Now, let me make a comparison, if I may, graphically, between the evidence of the resurrection, which appears in the New Testament. There it is, including the slight references in Revelations to the one who comes with a sword from his mouth. But, you know, the other standard references of the resurrection, they fit quite comfortably on an A4 sheet, rather fewer than 600 words. To give you a comparison of that, something else that has something in the order of 600 words, a McDonald's Happy Meal menu. Now, would anybody here be convinced, let's say, of the nutritional value of a McDonald's Happy Meal on the basis of 600 words? Can we be convinced, therefore, that a few pages of the Gospel speak of some extraordinary event?
You said I could interrupt you, Ken.
Yep, sure be.
Wow. This is great. Okay, Bart Ehrman used to be an evangelical. This is our discussion time, and he's a neat guy. He really is. Bart Ehrman used to be an evangelical. Ken, we're not going to solve this by going back and forth. By the way, Bart Ehrman has said in his most recent book, it wasn't the manuscripts, it was the problem of evil that bothered him the most. So it wasn't...
Problem of evil.
It wasn't a... And then later, I'm sure he's bothered by the text, but he just said in his latest book, his latest revelation is, it's the problem of evil. But you know what? If you want to start going down the line, I mean, we could say, hey, this guy's converted by studying the evidence, this guy's converted by, and the list is long. As far as extraordinary events require extraordinary evidence, I keep saying over and over again, I'm only using text and data as allowed by almost the furthest folks down on that side. I didn't invent this. Here's my point. If they think it's good enough to talk about it, perhaps you'll allow me to use their data and talk about it. I don't think that's weak. I think there's a lot of other data here we could put on the table. I'd be glad to do that. For example, I mean, it'd be a wild herring. But if somebody's saying something like, well, how am I supposed to believe in resurrection today? I mean, this is an extraordinary event. I think he started something like this. It started with this kind of idea. You know, we're in the fairy tale world. I'll just put something out here, and we can pursue it during the Q&A if you want to. Recent studies of near-death experiences, highly evidenced ones. I've been studying this phenomenon for 30 years. This is the only point I'm going to make by bringing this up. If we have evidence for an afterlife, if we do, and I think we do, then all of a sudden the resurrection doesn't look like the most extraordinary thing in the world that takes extraordinary evidence. It looks like a specific case of a phenomena for which we have other data. So I'll just throw that out there. If someone wants extraordinary evidence, let's talk about empirical data from the present. We can do that. But, you know, I'd love to go back and forth here on some scholars. I'd love to talk about, you know, Bob Price and, And you do know, right, that Bob's like the only guy in the universe who holds that view. I mean, there's a couple other people, but almost nobody.
I don't think so. But surely the nature of a debate is to go backwards and forwards.
Go ahead. How many others do you know besides Bob?
I don't want to discuss scholars. I don't want to go through just quoting names. I'd rather deal with some facts
here.
Thing, Gary, in your exposition is how interestingly you backtrack from your overall view to minimalistic claims then, okay? If we can prove that quite a few of the Pauline epistles are fraudulent, then you're quite happy to dish them. Make do with the ones you've got left. Well, you know, is this a scientific method? I mean, what sort of method it is? This is the sort of thing that I began by saying. Christian apologetics is simply the determination to defend ancient truths at all costs. And
it
so
is.
You will bring forward...
But atheism is not that.
You will bring forward any and every...
Humanism is nothing
use
like
you
that,
can
is it?
To defend an indefensible position. You know, that should...
But Ken, that's precisely why I've chosen this methodology, not to cite my facts. Dom Crossan, Gert Ludemann, the Jesus Seminar, are not very well known for being evangelical apologists. In fact, they really hate it. And I'm using their data, and I'm saying, what's the best argument for this? Dom Crossan has just said recently, Tom Wright, for those of you who know Bishop Tom Wright, we're going to be together in London in just 2 days. Great guy, 800-page book on the resurrection. He argues the evidence. Guess what? He's debated Dom Crossan 3 times. I was there all 3 times. And I heard Dom say this in all 3 debates. Do you know what? I've been thinking about this material for a whole long time, and I think Tom's right on this. What? Now, I want to make it clear. Dom does not believe in the resurrection. But he thinks Tom's argument is right on. So I'm saying... this doesn't sound like a fallacious Christian apologist, believers are out of control. We're using Dom Cross's type data and going after it. They're your friends.
Gary, surely the point here is if we are rational, we will be led by the evidence.
That's right.
We will not put the horse behind the cart and say, this is the truth that we want to establish. We know the truth. It comes to us by faith. Therefore, what facts can we purport to prove this truth? Now, that is not a scientific method.
That is simply
apologetics.
I don't argue that way. In fact, what you may not know about me is I spent 10 years as a skeptic, and you ready? I used to debate Christians, and I used to tell them they were crazy. And I either became a Buddhist or I was very close to be. I don't know why, but I was somewhere else down the religious trail. I came back to this not because I'm exercising faith and I'm just, golly gee, looking for facts to back up my faith. I said, what do I do with this data? And frankly, this is just my personal testimony. It doesn't mean a lot, but I mean, it was the resurrection that jerked me back from this kind of stuff. Not, okay, here comes my faith, please let me find some data. It was the other way around.
Well, that is what you say, but I am losing track of the number of Christian apologists who claim to have been hard-headed atheists. You know, it's now it's a par for the course. Well, I have to say, I have never been a Christian. I have always been a hard-headed atheist, and I have never seen anything that would come close to making me think, hey, the resurrection looks like a real event.
You know what? You need to come over to my house in the States. We'll talk over soccer, and we'll be working on that.
I'll happily do that. But I think if we are attempting to prove a historical truth, we can't begin with a conclusion and say, how can we come out with that result?
What's the conclusion?
Well, your conclusion is the resurrection is an historical fact, whatever.
No, I'm saying if you go back to
35... Do you entertain the possibility then it may not be true?
Absolutely.
You do?
Absolutely.
Okay, well,
there is
hope then. There is hope.
Yes, sir. I absolutely maintain it. And I will absolutely give it up. Hear me? I will absolutely give it up if the data are not there.
Well, tell me which of your defenses of the resurrection then really convinces you. Never mind all this special pleading. Which of all of them really convinces you? Let's take one practice. Let me give you, for example, in many of your books, in fact, all of them probably, you make this claim that the disciples suffered unto death for their beliefs.
No, I don't say they suffered unto death. I said they were willing to suffer. It's a, you know why the reason why I do that, Ken?
Well, it's safer. It's safer because the evidence doesn't support it. That's
exactly.
Why.
Not the safer one, the evidence one. I don't say that. And just today at Oxford University, I said to the students, don't say that all the disciples died for their faith. We don't have early data for that. And I went through it. The reason I don't say it is not because it's safer. I say it because we don't have data. But the four people who are there in Jerusalem, we do have first century data for three of the four. Peter, Paul, and James, the brother of Jesus. Only John, we do not have first century. But I don't go around saying we can prove the seven the other disciples. There's about seven of them, Eusebius, I think. I don't cite Eusebius. He's too late. He fails my own rules.
Yes, okay. Do you want to quote the Epistle of Clement?
I'd love to. What do you want to know about it?
Well, okay, because that because that is one of your standard defenses, that they even Peter and Paul died.
That's correct. Yeah? What's wrong with Clement?
Yeah. Well, shall we actually quote the words? Does he actually say they were martyred?
He both said... Yes.
No, he does not.
Wait a minute. Well, it depends on which... Here we go. It depends on which manual... There's two translations of Clement. One is very, very clear. They suffered martyrdom. The weaker of the two, the strong one specifically says they testified to Jesus Christ and went to their graves as martyrs believing, the stronger one. Even the weakest translation says something like this. It says, Paul and Peter went to their reward believing. They died. He says they died. That's the weaker.
Okay. I mean, I think that's closer to the words
that's
I
close.
Have.
Okay.
Okay. Says nothing. It says nothing. They did their work for Christ, as it would be, and then they died. Maybe they were with their Lord in heaven.
For their faith.
No evidence that they were ever martyrs.
No. Okay, here's where we can argue about it all night. But the scholar's interpretation of 1 Corinthians 5, Clement 5, not the 1 Corinthians of Paul, but Clement 5, is that Clement is talking about martyrdom. I'll even say, I'll bet you'll find that if you go back and do the research. But of the stronger statement, it's clearly true. And now James, the brother of Jesus.
And can we declare what the original meaning of the word martyr was?
What do you mean, can we declare the...
The word martyr actually means witness.
Fine.
It doesn't mean anyone who suffered and died.
Do you know who it started with?
Well, I'm sure he will tell us.
Justin Martyr, 2nd century...
Okay, much later than your apostles.
Oh, sure, but my point is, just to establish the word martyr, well, it's 50 years later, it's not hugely later, he goes to his death for his testimony as a Christian philosopher and he dies. He dies for that. By the way, the other one is James, and it's reported by Josephus, the stoning of James, the fourth one.
Well, we can come back to that one, but I'd like to stick with this point about what Christians understand by the idea of persecution and what Christians understand by the idea of martyrdom. Because it's quite clear that early Christians certainly thought any form of treatment that didn't accord with their wishes was some form of persecution. That if their family were critical of their Christian faith, they were being persecuted. And their martyrdom was actually to witness to the faith that they had. It had nothing to do with suffering unto death or a willingness to suffer unto death. Well, and we really don't have, as you say, of most of the so-called 12 apostles. We could argue about the four that we do have.
Okay. Paul gives a list of things he suffered. Remember, shipwrecked 3 times, beaten 40 minus 1. Actually... beaten 40 minus 1 3 times. He's stoned and left for dead outside. Paul lists these things he went through, and then tradition tells us he was finally beheaded during the reign of Nero in the early 60s.
No evidence.
Okay, but all I'm saying is, I think that's a fair definition of persecution. Being stoned and left for dead, whipped 3 times, 40 minus 1 lashes... I think those are fair definitions. I think he's justified in saying it was persecuted.
How would that be so if we're dealing with a religious tract that has no basis in fact? How do we know that
What's the religious tract?
How do we know that what Paul wrote was actually truthful? Who else validates the claims of Paul? Unlike Jesus Christ, which you can claim is referred to here and there, nobody else refers to Paul. Jesus doesn't appear in any secular history at all.
He does appear in one secular source, and he does appear in five Christian sources that can be considered early. Now, if Christians are prejudiced because they mention Paul, then atheists are prejudiced for confirming atheism. I mean, it's not like atheists are automatically valueless and Christians have all kinds of values. Both sides have axes to grind.
I don't think anyone makes themselves rich by being an atheist. But plenty of people make themselves rich by being Christians.
But what does that have to do with who's prejudiced?
It means they have a vested interest in maintaining untruths in a way that an unbeliever does not.
But you don't have an axe to grind. You just come at this totally neutrally, and you don't have any beliefs. You bring nothing to the data. I'm not being nasty, but a cure for that is a course in philosophy.
I, like anybody else, including yourself, Gary, have subjective views on things.
You sure do, and so do I.
But what is the more extraordinary claim, then? That God exists and raises people from the dead, or in the absence of any evidence to that effect, that it is not true?
Well, Ken, it's certainly not in the absence of evidence, but you say, which is more extraordinary? See, your comment betrays the same kind of angle, the prejudice that we all have. It betrays the same thing. When you say, what in the world could make you believe in God or resurrection or afterlife or something like that? That's a complicated thesis that we're unwarranted in conceding only from a naturalistic viewpoint. If God exists, and if there's an afterlife and if there's a resurrection, it's all of a sudden it's just not uncomplicated, it's the answer for the universe. What I mean is for you to say, that's an extraordinary thesis and incredible to believe. Because if you're an atheist, of course it is. That shows that kind of angle that I'm saying philosophy will kind of knock out of you if you take a philosophy class. It tells us we all have an axe to grind, and your view from my angle is incredible, and my view from your angle is incredible. That both shows we have an angle.
I don't believe the rejection of the extraordinary and the fantastic and the fabulous in the absence of clear proof is an axe to grind. That should be the position that we all adopt. We should not believe the extraordinary unless it can be disproved. I mean, that would be lunacy. Why don't we believe in Jack and the Beanstalk
or Snow White
or any such story?
We're back at the beginning of your paper or your speech, which was, took some notes here, it's sad that religion is still with us today. Ken, the reason we're still talking about religion in the city of David Hume is because, listen, if there were no data and a bunch of fanatics from both sides, because we're all, everyone's got an axe to grind, running around giving both sides, it wouldn't have survived. The reason we're still talking about it, and there's a Tom Wright who's taught at both Oxford and Cambridge, there's a Jimmy Dunn at Durham, that there's a Larry Hurtado right here at Edinburgh. The reason these folks are around, that Richard Burridge at London, Richard Baucom just retires from, the reason that goes on in academia, guess what? I think they would be drummed out of court if there weren't some data to talk about. It wouldn't be around. Because listen, if these guys are doing this kind of stuff, folks, let me tell you about my belief. I believe in Christianity. Now let's all try this semester to find some facts to back up our faith. I don't think they'd be full professors. I don't think they'd be around it. I feel too strongly about the British universities to say, those guys hold important chairs for reasons. Now quoting the names isn't going to help us, but the names show data. The names show reasons to believe. And I think the reason they hold these chairs, Larry Hurtado, I understand, is the head of the department here at Edinburgh. The reason they're still alive is because there's still data to talk about, like this right here.
What you are not acknowledging in that statement, Gary, is that the church is an institution of society that dominated Europe for 1,500 years. We have only escaped its clutches in the last 200. You know, of course there is a religious establishment, and it has its centres of power and authority. It has all the gloss of being part of the establishment. Of course it regards any rational critique as equally as fanatical as itself.
So the church runs Oxford and Cambridge.
No, it doesn't.
And
but if the origins of those universities are very much connected with the church.
But I mean, if the Pope or Rowan, you know. Rowan Williams is going to say something like, this is what we believe in this country. I think you ought to have chairs at Durham and Edinburgh. And that's not going to put... Oxford doesn't listen to the church.
Yeah, but you're putting history backwards. You're putting history backwards. Where were those centers of authority before the modern era? They were in the hands of the church.
That's fine. But this is 2008, and this is a secular university system in your country, in my country. These are secular university systems.
Well, you have more than a secular university
system.
That's
fine. Okay, yeah. Fine. Ken, in a secular university system, I'll ask the same question you asked when you started your paper. Why are we still talking about this in a secular university system with major chairs at Oxford, Cambridge, and Edinburgh? Why? It's not because there's nothing to talk about, or we wouldn't be talking about them.
As you wish, as you wish.